In this episode of New Classical Tracks, you'll have a chance to meet Miss Mary. She's actually a Guarneri Dal Gesu violin from 1735. She once was Fritz Kreisler's violin, and now she's in the hands of violinist Francisco Fullana. You'll meet Miss Mary, and you'll also find out how jazz influenced this Spanish violinist in this week's episode of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher. I'm talking with Francisco Fullana, who has a brand new recording out. It's called Through the Lens of Time. Thank you for joining me, Francisco.
Hello, how is it going?
Great. Now, is this your first recording?
Yeah, it's the debut CD.
For listeners who may not be familiar with you, tell us a little bit about who you are and how we might hear you maybe out in a performance setting or something.
Yeah, well, I'm a Spanish violinist. I grew up in Spain and, I came to Juilliard to study and, I've been in the U.S. for now 11 years. And I'm also the principal violinist of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. And, if you're out in the East Coast in New York, you'll probably also catch me as a member of the Lincoln Center Chamber Music Society.
So you're pretty busy.
Yeah, well, that's musicians, You're never in one place.
You're putting on a lot of frequent flyer miles.
Oh, yes.
Have you had any trouble transporting your violin? I know some musicians have struggled with getting it through security.
Oh, yeah. These old violins are very expensive, very fragile, and, but I've never had, fortunately, knock on wood, any problem like that. Sometimes you have to argue, but, you figure it out.
So that would be... that would be a tremendous challenge, especially because of the instrument you play. And she has a nickname. You call her Miss Mary.
Yes.
Tell us about this beautiful instrument.
Yeah, I'm so lucky to play with her and to be, almost with this violin, almost you feel like the guardian or the kind of caretaker. This is a Guarneri Dal Gesu. It was made in 1735 in Cremona. And it's part of the Stradivarius Society of Chicago. I've been a recipient with them since 2013, and about 2 years ago, I had the opportunity to just try this violin, and I just fell in love. I've been playing on lucky enough, to play really nice old Italian violins for about 10 years, but this is the very first time that it really feels I can just play. Like, I never have to second guess or adjust in any way. It's the most natural fit, and whatever people like it or not, my playing, that's a separate story. But I know that what's coming out there and what the audience is receiving is exactly what I'm feeling or what I'm trying to communicate.
Now, was I reading that this instrument kind of has a quality that allows you to really fill a bigger space?
Yeah, I mean, Guarneris are very well known for that's what they're famous for, is the volume and the almost like in your face, like this huge sound. And of course, Miss Mary definitely has that side of it. But what I think makes this violin so even more special is that it has this really sweet, you can really, if you get to know the violin and, you have this almost relationship with it in a certain way, you can tap into this really sweet tone and these colors that actually usually they don't have them. One of the cool things about the instrument was that Fritz Kreisler was one of the players that played on it, one of the most famous violinists of all time. And he was very well known exactly for that kind of sound. I like to think that's why he probably fell in love with the instrument.
I always wonder when you have an opportunity to use an instrument like that, that has an old soul and it has those connections, is there ever a point where you almost feel like you're kind of tapping into performer or...
I mean, that's, every instrument, the performer really almost molds the violin and the violin molds the performer. And when it changes hands, the instrument kind of carries that that sound and that way of playing through time. I mean, that's a thing that if you talk to a lot of violinists, I'm sure they feel the same way. But with this, you know, the older and the most, you know, the more maybe more special, more unique instrument, they also have this huge personality. That so it's so important that, you know, you have to fit with it, and you have to sometimes if you get a violin that doesn't quite fit, you have to make this huge adjustment and kind of put away some of what you would say or your own voice in order to serve that instrument. So I think that's what makes this relationship so unique, because then I can just, you know, I don't have to give up anything that I have to say in order to adjust to it. It's just really the perfect match.
So is this the instrument we're hearing on your debut recording through the lens of time? So this recording is, I guess, for lack of a better description, it's a dialogue between the Baroque and the modern world. And how is this happening? Tell me how this project came to be.
Yeah, well, it almost came as a coincidence. I think of it that, you know, you have all these small decisions, those small moments that all of a sudden they come together and, you know, make something like this project happen. About 3 years ago or so, an artistic director of the San Antonio Chamber Orchestra mentioned to me, you know, I want you to know this piece and I want you to play it. We're going to bring Carlos Izcaray, who's a conductor from Alabama Symphony, which I've known when we were teenagers back at Aspen Music Festival, like more than 10 years ago. And I want you guys to play it together. And I'm like, oh, I'm happy to play with Carlos. It seems like a really interesting piece. And then, you know, we got to rehearsal, and even from the first rehearsal, there was just this connection. We got coffee after the concert or, you know, the next day, and we're like, you know, we're going to play it in Alabama, but also we want to record it and really make it the project. And, you know, about 3 weeks later, I was performing for the first time the Isangyun that's also on the album. That piece is a passacaglia on Bach's musical offering, the royal theme. And he builds this crazy, you know, this kind of crazy structures on top. It's really virtuosic and quite challenging. It kind of made me find this relationship and this bridges between the Baroque and the new music that, you know, that I've been almost obsessing over for the past few years and really trying to explore and, you know, try to bring into my recital programs where, you know, you bring together something from Bach or a Locatelli or Vivaldi, and then you play like something like the Richter or the Jun or the Schnittke.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the Suite in Old Style by Alfred Schnittke, because this is a piece that takes us back to the 18th century, but also to the 1970s.
Yes.
Because people had kind of a different perspective of Baroque music then.
Oh, yeah.
Talk a little bit about this piece and how we hear those two different sides of it.
If we listen now to someone like Heifetz playing Bach sonatas and partitas, I mean, there are still some of the best recordings out there, but the performance practice of the Baroque music has completely changed. And, you know, at least a large part of the musicians today, you know, either play at different tuning with gut strings and all that, but even if you're playing on a modern instrument, you still have the sound that, you know, the scholars and the, you know, there's been all this research done, and, you know, we try to go back to that 18th century aesthetic. But during Schnittke, when he wrote the suite, that was not, definitely not what, you know, what you heard in concerts when they played Bach. And so I think the suite for me has that juxtaposition, this overlap between the style, the really the writing of the suites, the cello suites, the sonatas and partitas by Bach, but then also has this aesthetic from, you know, the way Heifetz would play a Bach partita. ¶¶ so fascinating now as a performer, in, you know, in 2018 to kind of, you have to transport yourself to both of those eras.
You mentioned the Lee Sung-yoon mm-hmm. piece. He is a South Korean, or was a South Korean composer. And his story is very interesting. And I know we really need to know his story to understand this piece. Would you share that, please?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's a very tragic story. Lee Sung-yoon grew up in Korea and left to Japan to study during the war. After the war was over, the ceasefire, he came back. He was originally born on the North Korean side, what is today North Korea, but he came back to South Korea and became an activist for trying to, you know, reunification and to come to actually peace and use his music in that kind of way. But after a few years, he decided to move to Germany, study composition, and became this big name that became friends with some of the biggest stars. I mean, John Cage and Karajan and Stravinsky and really some of the biggest names. About, you know, I want to say like I think it's 12 or 15 years later, one day he was walking down the street with his wife. He got abducted by South Korean spies and they put him in a plane and accused him of treason in his own country and sentenced him to life, sentenced his wife to, I think, 10 years in prison. And, you know, of course, it'd be, you know, an outrage both diplomatically and, you know, I mean, for a foreign government to take one of their, you know, to go to a different country to abduct one of their citizens and to put them in a plane. Of course, West Germany was furious, but the South Koreans wouldn't budge. And 55 letters later from those big names that really respected his music, and after a three-year process and 3 years in prison, he finally, they allow him to leave the country. He went back to Germany and he never came back. So for him, I think, you know, the kind of the hospitality and the help that Germany provided to him, it was, of course, his second home. But I think there's this really deep relationship and really deep respect for their culture and what music means to them. And I this is what I hear anyway with this piece, because he really pays, of course, homage to Bach, to the German tradition. But also pays homage to or uses some of the techniques that from the Second Viennese schools, from Schoenberg. I mean, some of the variations in the piece are 12-tone based. I like to think of it as almost having Bach's long shadow, you know, feeling that mountain behind him. And, you know, of course, he brings in some of his Korean tradition, and you know, some of the melodies are very much, they don't sound Western in any way. He talks about how music is circular, and that's exactly what this piece is, because you can play it till the very end and it's end the exact way, it's the same way that it starts. And it's just with the royal theme from the musical offering from Bach. And, you know, he every variation, he keeps building and building. It's faster, crazier, more intense. But underneath, that line never stops. And then eventually, it comes, let's go, and goes back to the original, and that's how the piece ends. I think it really relates to his life, kind of a miniature of the story of his life.
Let's touch on the other piece that we haven't talked about yet, which is by Salvador Bertans, and it's a set of variations on a Baroque theme for solo violin, and it's really beautiful.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's actually based on I am from Mallorca, it's an island in the Mediterranean Sea, and probably our most well-known composer of the past is Antoni Gutierrez, who wrote a lot of zarzuelas. He's a very well-known composer. And his most well-known song is this this piece, this beautiful melody, and the text basically it talks about this bird jumping from branch to branch, from tree to tree. And I was trying to find a, you know, I wanted to commission somebody that had a special place in my life and in my path. As you know, as a debut album, you want to have as much personal connection as possible. The first and last person I thought about was Bretons. He was the music director of the symphony that I ever, the first time I ever played with an orchestra in my hometown in Palma. And he's also an amazing composer. We talked on the phone. I was like, well, look, the whole album is, you know, based on this idea of bridging the old and the new, the Baroque, and how composers of our time look back at it. And, you know, so he was the one who actually suggested the piece to kind of base it off. And he takes this journey where he tries to almost replicate the guitarist, the style, the really simple and early Baroque sound at the very beginning of the piece. And as the variations go by, he really keeps it for quite a long time. But then, towards the last third of the piece or so, then you really hear Bretons the way that I'm used to, which is this really, really energetic and really rhythmical and with a lot of kind of like an edginess to it. And in a way, like Isang Yun, he still keeps that theme and that sound underneath, on top of the edginess. You still hear that Baroque sound. So it's always a balance between the two.
So how did Max Richter's The Four Seasons Recomposed fit into this concept and become part of the project? Or maybe this was the starting point.
Well, I think the two starting points were both the Richter piece, The Four Seasons Recomposed, and the Isang Yun. I mean, as I, you know, I played it within 4 weeks, you know, of each other for the first time, and they both fascinated me. And in the case of the Richter, for me, I think it just fits this kind of energetic and really intense playing or, you know, way of thinking that I have about music, and especially about 20th century music and Baroque. And it really brings those two sides that I'm really in love with and I love performing together. It takes some of Vivaldi's melodies and materials and really brings that intense, you know, almost like the Italian Baroque energy that you hear in a Vivaldi or in Locatelli, and really brings it to a whole new level. I mean, it's really crazy and really fun to play.
So The Four Seasons by Vivaldi, very familiar work. It's a work that you've known since you were a kid. How has Max Richter re-energized that work?
Yeah, well, you know, he does it in completely different ways. And I think of Richter's piece as a completely new work. I mean, he really, of course, uses a lot of the materials from Vivaldi. But even from the very first moment, the first moment of Spring, there's no way you think it's Vivaldi. He takes 2.5 bars of the first solo of the piece, the concertmaster and the principal second, and then brings it into his own sound world. I mean, Max Richter is well known for his influences from minimalism and almost non-classical music, and he brings his gestures, and almost like, to me, it's like you're in the middle of a forest and these birds are talking to each other, and you know, each gesture from Vivaldi becomes a different bird, and you know, everybody just kind of like a big piece of chamber music. He takes Vivaldi's original and just either adds or subtracts a single note, and you know, when you're playing it or when the audience is listening to it, it takes you from late 1600s, early 1700s, completely into the 21st century. There's no way that you can think that it's just Baroque music. It has this almost this non-classical feeling to it. And then the fast passages that I think is also another of the staples in this piece, In some of the climaxes, you have the orchestra kind of keep going with this really rhythmic pattern, some of them irregular, but then the solo line just goes on into on top of it, just kind of going crazy, almost like a guitar solo in a rock band. It's such a memorable feeling and energy when you're on stage and the orchestra is triple forte, going full out, and then on top of that you're just playing this crazy 32nd notes and really going all the way to the very end of the movement.
So I have to ask you, do you ever feel kind of like a rock star when you're playing this?
Well, I do, I like to wear some crazy clothes, a little more extravagant clothes when I play this piece specifically. Yeah, when you're playing those fast note passages at the climaxes, I mean, you're as far away of the classical realm as you can be without coming completely outside of it. And I think the key is to really let go and not be afraid of going to that extreme. Really get into that very edge of your playing, of your volume, of your colors, of your this type of sound that you're trying to get. You really have to push it. That's what I think brings this piece to life.
So we were talking about bridging between Baroque and contemporary music. Is this also possibly, as you just alluded to, bridging between classical and other styles of music that would invite people in to maybe consider classical music?
Exactly. I mean, what I think this piece is, the Richter is so fascinating is because he taps into both, as I said, periods, different period, the Baroque coming in, but then a piece that's so popular that everybody recognizes those melodies. And, we've been listening to it. You probably, I don't remember the first time I ever heard Vivaldi's Four Seasons. And it's kind of just part of the culture, and really it's part of anybody's life. And also brings in all these influences from rock, from jazz.
Has jazz inspired you in any way, and in a way that you've brought to this piece?
Oh, yes. I went to Juilliard, and, it's one of the... I was lucky enough to meet all these fantastic jazz musicians. I mean, one of my classmates was Jean Baptiste, who's now the lead man for the band at the Stephen Colbert Late Show. And I know all the musicians in the band also went to, they were his classmates and my classmates. And, so I had this amazing exposure to jazz, just seeing my friends, my colleagues play. So they would take me to this really cool jazz shows that I probably wouldn't have gone on my own because I just didn't know enough. And one of the most memorable ones for me, I remember, I think I was 19 or I was like my second or third year at Juilliard. I went to the Jazz Gallery, which is this kind of alternative jazz space in New York where a lot of the jazz musicians actually go listen to some jazz. And Chris Potter, which is an incredible virtuosic sax player, was playing. And I didn't know what to expect. I never heard even of his name. And, I just remember how mesmerized I was. I mean, it was really seeing like Paganini playing the saxophone. And once I was playing the Richter, I remember, and, all of a sudden it just kind of clicked. I was practicing this passage in the end of the first movement of Summer. And I was like, what is, like, there's something in my head that I can kind of, I couldn't, it's almost in the tip of my tongue, I couldn't figure out what it was. And then it kind of clicked. It was, oh yeah, that's exactly why whenever I listen to Chris Potter's playing and style, it kind of inspired me to really try to not replicate it, but to be inspired by that crazy, all-out playing where he just takes you and, almost seems like it's never going to stop. And to that energy and that intensity to push it that far like he does, I hope to, in those few moments when the listener hears them in the CD or live, I hope, they have a similar feeling that I had when I listened to him for the first time.
You've mentioned a few sections within this work that are really special to you. Is there anything else? Is there like another season that you want to mention a section of it that's like, be sure to have us tune into that?
Yeah, well, you know, we've been talking about this, all these crazy passages and, you know, the really fast and, you know, almost like pushing the limit kind of spots. But for me, my favorite movement to perform, and, you know, I hope the listener also feels that way when they listen to it, is the second movement of Winter. You know, he actually leaves the solo violin part from the Vivaldi exactly the same. But just puts two words next to it, which is ad libitum. Instead of, you know, following the rhythm, he kind of instructs the performer to take as much liberty and freedom and time and take it as far as you want. But what I think makes it so interesting is that he changes the accompaniment. In the Vivaldi, the poem talks about the crackling of the fire and how, you know, it's almost like watching the winter from inside, like from this warm and, you know, really cozy place. But Richter actually changes it completely. It puts all these harmonics underneath that, you know, I always say that instead of being inside the glass, you're right outside. So you see the fire crackling, but you're freezing to death. And it's very eerie. I mean, it's like almost like being in a really dark night in the middle of the winter. And then all of a sudden, you hear this incredible melody soaring on top. It's such a beautiful image to me, and I would say, as fun as the really fast parts are, it's probably my favorite movement.
I just realized when I was asking you earlier about how you knew the work of Vivaldi from when you were really young, did you really listen to it on a never-ending loop on a cassette?
Yes, you've read my program notes. So, yeah, you know, my mom, she was obsessed with this recording of the Four Seasons and each season was performed by a different violinist. It was Perlman, Zuckerman, Stern, and Mintz. Playing one season each, and Maida conducting, Zvi Maida. And, I mean, it was one of the few cassettes that we had in the car to listen on road trips or even just going to the conservatory or going to school. And, I mean, I'm not kidding. It's at least 70-80% of the time was that Vivaldi CD. So I remember I had a concert up in the north of Spain in Oviedo, and sitting in the back of this, you know, big, like, van that we had. And yeah, that was playing, and it's the most in this place in the middle of the mountains. They were kind of driving through this canyon, and you know, I don't know why I have this image of that I associate to the Four Seasons, but it really it's almost like one of the images that I've always had looking back at my childhood, and so you know, I think that stuck with me, and I definitely kind of relate to it now, you know, 15, 20 years later.
And that's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. With special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode, I'm Julie Almacher.